some dharma activities. The schedule says chanting. We will do some chanting, but before that, I want to make sure that I respond to your questions and clarifications before I pick up next topic. This next topic means we are going to expand. So before I do that, any questions, clarifications? So, any clarifications? I want to make sure that you're here and you learn step-by-step practice guidelines to yourself for now. And of course, afterwards, you can actually create your own step system. But for now, since you came here, I feel responsible to have some concrete step system practice. Okay? So, any questions, any clarifications? What you have heard, what you share?
Mm-hmm. So, Chaitanya, as you were talking about like opposites, or what is it called? When you do one and it helps the other. What is that word? It's
an antidote.
Yes.
Okay. So, I was missing one. I was just curious, but I think they're interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So, happiness was with sorrow, gain and loss.
Oh, I see.
Praise and defamation.
Praise. And criticism.
Criticism.
Yeah.
Okay.
Praise.
And there was one more.
And then fame and defame.
Okay, there it is. I missed.
Yeah. Fame and defame.
Okay.
And it's.
Okay.
So that they're called 8 worldly conditions. And it's really important to know these 8 conditions, worldly conditions, because our life is bound by these 8 conditions. So once you know these 8, then you learn how to balance them. So you will have equanimity or equilibrium. So I'm going to share a little bit about that. So usually we experience happiness. And we may take ourselves to the extreme happiness. That means the happiness without any insight. So you encounter some happy moment and you take yourself 100% like a manic state. And of course, because it is extreme happiness, so there's no insight, there's no awareness of happiness changing sometime. So we have taken our state of mind happiness so high and also use all energy, all resources. very, very, I guess, compulsive that way. And of course, if we take ourselves that extreme, naturally it will come down very hard. And so then we will experience the opposite of happiness, which is suffering or unhappiness. And so that, of course, is a mood swings. And so mood swings are very, very unstable. And so the antidote for that is finding equanimity between these extreme experiences. So that means if you are doing Dharma practice, Buddhist practice, then you are enjoying happiness. At the same time, there's some awareness of happiness. The awareness of happiness that somewhere in your consciousness, that this happiness might change. So some reflection about impermanence, impermanent nature of the happiness. Now, so sometimes people don't like that. Oh, I want to enjoy my happiness fully. I don't want to shortcut or reduce my happiness. Well, if we do not have this insight or awareness, then when happiness ends, then we will go down very extreme sadness or unhappiness. So therefore, the antidote for that is to have a balance between happiness and the reality of happiness, that is, subject of change. But anyhow, my point here is, if we feel happy, there is nothing to be too happy and excited about happiness, because happiness will change, or because happiness itself is impermanent. Now, it may balance a little bit. And so with that awareness, when happiness changes, then we will not be that emotional. We will not be totally collapsed or sad about the loss of the change of happiness. Okay? So that's how it is used. On the other hand, if we experience suffering, unhappiness, and we could also have some insight while we are experiencing the opposite, unhappiness. Again, if we feel sad or unhappy or some degree of suffering, the attitude is that I don't have to be too upset, because it is also impermanent. So it's a very, very fair. You equalize these extreme emotions, applying concept of impermanence. That's how actually many Dharma practitioners do. So with that, then our emotion remains quite balanced. It may not go like this. So what it means, this is another example of how to apply selflessness, emptiness or selflessness in our daily life. When we are caught up with our self, self-ness, I guess, self-centered attitudes, then we overly identify with our thoughts and emotions. That's why we have these very, very extreme mood swings, because when we feel happy, we overly identify that happiness. And if we feel sad, unhappiness, then also overly identified with that sadness. Then, of course, we lose ourselves. What exists is the suffering. And, of course, we feel overwhelmed. So what you're learning is, you are trying to distance yourself from the emotions, so you are not overly identifying with that thought and emotion. And it happens with the child, teenagers and adults our age. So you have some favorite object, whatever that is, relationship or car or house or maybe some jewelry or Rolex, I don't know what male females have. So if you overly identify with that object, and then object breaks up, and then we also feel break up. That's because the self and thought and emotion all are fused. And so if you lost your favorite object item, if you overly identify with that, then you also feel that you are also lost. I guess it indicates how strong attached we are. So strong attachment also means overly identifying with that outside object or inside internal experiences. Okay? So selfless meaning that whenever you are able to separate yourself from emotions, then you are practicing selflessness, self-in-context. What does that mean? Self-in-context. Self-in-context. What does that mean? It's an English word, right?
In the context of what's happening.
Yeah.
I think that's what it means, the context of what's happening right now.
Mm.
Maybe you see yourself sort of engulfed in that experience and can't see outside of the experience.
Mm. Now, self in context, meaning you are able to see.
Okay.
You're able to see yourself separately from your thoughts and emotions. But the fusion of self and our thoughts, emotion, is not able to see separate.
That's good, right?
Yeah. Well, not the fusion is good. Diffusion, the separateness, the able to see self as self, and emotion as emotion, but not like identifying oneself through that.
Mm.
Okay. So self in context meaning that you are able to see the thoughts, emotions, and self, they are just different. They are separate. So if you have stories, positive stories about life, negative stories about life, so sometimes we are really caught up by that story, and we and the story become one.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens with traditions, politics, these political systems, those some people become one with their tradition, they become very, very fundamental, what they think. And that means they themselves really fused, became one, what they value, and not able to see other perspectives. Okay. So I expand a little bit more detail, but let me go back what I was sharing. So the other is this opposing mental factors, let's say gain and loss. So the gain and loss, you apply the same. So sometimes we have a gain. We might be happy, which is great. But sometimes when there's a gain, we become very, very excited, overly excited. And then become kind of extreme with that. And the extreme happens when there's no insight, insight of impermanence. So the point is, if I gain something, it is great, yet nothing to be excited very much, because gain is subject to change if I use impermanence again. And then I remain kind of balanced. So what it means is that you enjoy, you appreciate the gain, I don't know, 80%, but I have awareness inside of 20%. Can you do it? Or you just pick up 5% or 10% of this subtle concept of impermanence. But you still enjoy the gain. And then the other side, loss. So loss, of course, will be sad, and really, sometimes I think people say crushed or something, collapse, I don't know. Sounds very, very physical. So the practice is, yes, I feel loss, yet don't need to be too sad, because loss is also impermanence. So if I can go that, so let's say criticism and praise and criticism. Of course, people like praise. So people like when they receive praise. And so attitude is having equal between these two. Yes, praise is good, yet there's nothing to be excited about that, because there are other people who may criticize. So same thing. If we are criticized by someone, yes, it is upsetting, but not to be too upset about the criticism, because you remember, you recollect that there are some who actually praise, admire you, what you have done for them. Okay, so that's how you handle. That's how it is used. So it's a little bit detailed. Okay, so use the same, like for fame and defame. So there's always something, this one positive mental states, there's the negative state, and our tendency is get stuck with one of them and not able to access there's other side of the coin. Okay. So we just choose to see one side, like my eye, possibly.
Your eye.
my one eye, this left eye, is now quite blurry, and this one is like completely the extreme one. I guess I have to practice this between these two.
way.
I've thought about it, and I got some inspirations reflecting on other Buddhist scholars and teachers. I don't mean that I am equal, but I'm just finding if I got blind one side, then how would I would function and what my life would that change everything or will be fine. And suddenly I remember one of the great Indian scholar named Aryadeva. But anyhow, that's one. But I understood that it is the beginning of my aging process. I understand that that's how I learned actually from the person Dr. Nyima with whom I came to the West, Desho Rinpoche's brother, and he was very close to his death in Seattle. He's an uncle of Damgusho. And so we had a close connection with Damgusho and Dr. Nyima because of Desho Rinpoche's connection. But anyhow, I asked him because I wonder what people think about their life when they are close to die. And so I asked Dr. Nyima. Dr. Nyima is a very, very joyous person. He was, I think, about 75 when he passed away. But he's a very, very joyous person, and I asked, what do you think now? His response was that he understands no one dies without any cause and condition. And he said, this cancer must be the cause and condition of my death. And he said, he's ready. Okay, so what do you think? What do you think about that?
Yeah. Say the last words.
Yeah.
Hear them.
Yeah. He basically accepts.
Mm-hmm.
He basically accepts. So that's how these Buddhist teaching of suffering being inevitable part of our life, and also the reality of impermanence, and the law of causality. All these are designed to bring acceptance in our life. So obviously, he reached to that accepting level. And that can be very peaceful. Could be anxious. So, anyhow, so I actually reached some degree of acceptance. Whatever happens with my eye. All right, so, okay, any other questions? Yes?
It almost seems as though this 80%, 20%,
yes,
you know, for 80%, if you're in a happy state, leave 20% for the recognition of impermanence. It almost seems like that state is a zero-sum game. If you take it away, if you take something away from 100%, you're left with 80%. But actually, it doesn't feel to me like it works quite like that.
Mm-hmm.
It almost feels to me that the recognition of impermanence,
mm-hmm,
doesn't really have doesn't really take anything away,
mm-hmm, uh-huh,
from the happiness. In fact,
mm-hmm,
if,
mm-hmm,
you're not recognizing the impermanence, then it seems much,
yes,
more likely that you're going to be worrying about when is it going to end, where did it start, how can I make sure that it happens again? all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
So it really doesn't feel to me like
right.
it's a zero-sum game, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that's right. I have a kind of a story
yes, please,
I would
share.
Like to share a little bit
share,
of exactly
please,
this
share.
Point, except it's about a kind of a loss
yeah.
than a gain. But so most of you know I'm selling my house and you know I'm buying a new house with my girlfriend. So it's a nice, it's a happy circumstance. But a couple weeks ago, I went into my meditation room, and most of you don't know that I had a very elaborate meditation room with tankas and some of these statues here and things that I had brought back from trips to Asia, pictures of Dzogchen Rinpoche and Dhamma Kusho,
yes.
and a room that I had repainted and fixed up the room. I had invested a lot of energy. In
identity. Your identity.
Yeah, I was, that's right, exactly. I was very identified with that because I poured a lot of my Buddhist identity and energy into
yes.
that, you
yes.
know, and Jamyang had dedicated that room
yes.
know, to that use. And so I went in to sit down to do what I figured would be one of the last times I went to sit because I was going to, you know, get the house ready to sell and I didn't really want to sell it with a Buddhist shrine room in there. So. And
oh,
within about 5 minutes, it just overwhelmed me. I mean, I was like totally in tears and totally overwhelmed by it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, just, and but at the same, but very quickly at the same time, I had this awareness, you know, I have no regrets about the decision I'm making to sell this house, to move to the new house with Nancy. You know, there's a great plan in place. It's not a huge loss, but it's a big transition still, kind
yeah.
of, you know. And it was exactly how you describe it, really. It was, it, I mean, I fully experienced this loss. I mean, I was in tears on and off for quite a while. But at the same time, I had no regrets
mm-hmm.
about the decision to let it go and that it was just going to change and eventually there'd be something else. And so that awareness was there, but it didn't diminish the feeling, you know?
The
and
feeling
so
of the loss.
It didn't diminish
right.
the sense
yeah.
of loss or
mm-hmm.
my need to kind of experience
yeah.
that loss.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt perfect, really, because
mm-hmm.
I needed to let that go. So I
right.
needed to have those tears and
right.
and all that emotion about letting
yeah.
that part go. But it was really, I could just, all the time, I could still see the impermanence, the change, the no regret, there's something else in place. So it's just like you said, you know, it didn't
mm-hmm.
take away
mm-hmm.
from that processing that emotion,
mm-hmm.
but it
mm-hmm.
helped balance it in
mm-hmm.
at different times in my life.
Mm-hmm.
It might have caused me a lot of upset. I might have started
mm-hmm.
questioning
right.
my decision to
mm-hmm.
sell the house
mm-hmm.
or be with Nancy or, you know, I mean, I could have gone a lot of ways. But I didn't, you know, and that was really good, yeah.
So what if we do not have that awareness, we do not have awareness of the change or impermanence, and we simply feel the loss, just loss.
Right.
Then it is really loss.
Yeah, then it really feels like loss.
Or unless you feel the loss and it, you process loss. This is what I found from my clinical experience. I found that grieving is one of the most effective method of non-attachment.
Mm.
So there's a loss and you go through the grief with kind support systems, then you process the grief and you are really able to separate yourself from the loss. So in other words, grieving itself is a practice of non-attachment,
mm-hmm.
letting go. So,
yeah.
so if we go through the, that's what we do. If you wonder why we have a 49 days after the death of someone, 49 days is a use to really process the grief And I know in your culture, when you write a condolence, you write it, of course, very differently. With the exception of Dalchen Rinpoche or higher teachers, we still include how the passing away of teacher or his holiness Dalchen Rinpoche is indication, it's a sign of like showing impermanence. And so still use. But if I send a letter to my relatives or friends whose relatives passed away, in my condolence it will say, it will say that the nature of impermanence has occurred. And encouraged to engage with the spiritual practices to manage the grieving of the loss. So in other words, we talk about impermanence and death and dying during 49 days, even like inviting weekly someone during that passing of a day to engage with some practices. So, anyhow. Okay. Any other thoughts, comments, questions?
Well, just one comment, and that's one, I always think of this, one reason that breathing is such a good object of meditation mm-hmm. is you could imagine breathing in as a game, but you can't breathe in forever.
Yes.
So the ideal state is kind of modulating, sort of in the middle, not always breathing in, always breathing out.
And I would just add to that what Domingo has been saying, what I was hearing and understanding is that just like all good things must end, all sad, bad things mm-hmm. must end, and that's what I forget sometimes. And so you can't breathe out forever either.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it occurred to me when you said that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But then we form this habit that some positive things should continue for a long time. If we don't have that perception, then we will not be affected very much when it changes. So we need to really work out with our perceptions. Okay, all right. Any other questions, comments before we move to the next topic? Okay, so let me share you a little bit. We will end this at 9. Is it okay for you? You'll be okay, I hope.
Okay.
But after 8, we'll have lots of fun activities. We're not sitting meditating. We may do all kinds of drama, kind of acting. Okay, now let's go back to the main points of compassion, bodhicitta, and emptiness. That is our main theme for this retreat. So up to now, we talk about cultivation of mainly loving kindness and compassion, but included joy and equanimity, some degree. So now, our path has to take next level. Because if we stay the same level, that means our antidote for our overcoming suffering remains same. And here's the reason why do we need to cultivate bodhicitta. In terms of antidote, we can summarize that all antidotes can be summarized into two. One is called suppressing antidote. Suppressing, just suppress. Just suppress the superficial level. Just suppressing, let's say, suppressing attachment, suppressing anger or aversion. The other antidote is called eliminating. So one is suppressing, other is eliminating. So loving kindness and compassion are very important practice, very important foundation practice. But loving kindness, compassion only suppresses suffering. It does not cut the root of the sources of suffering. For example, practice of compassion, loving kindness may suppress our anger towards oneself and others, but it may not eliminate the root source of suffering. Our root source of suffering is considered as self-grasping or self-clinging. All the afflictive thoughts and emotions, all our sufferings, even our happiness, are based on self-grasping. It makes sense that we need some degree of self-grasping in order to feel happiness or feel unhappiness or all other emotions. So the point is that when you practice loving kindness and compassion, you are not necessarily analyzing the selflessness. Compassion doesn't negate the self-grasping or doesn't negate the existence of self. Okay. The existence of self is constructed of our perception. For example, this bell looks quite concrete. The appearance-wise, it's very solid. And so we perceive that the reality of this bell is also solid. So we have not analyzed the very nature of this bell. If it looks solid, feels solid, hears solid, so it must be solid. Okay. But if you analyze thoroughly the existence of this self, the self of a bell, then you may able to break down either by hammer, physically, you break down and chop everything and try to find a bell. If you have some items like this this summer, and you use your hammer and find the solidity of that object by using hammer, you will find that whatever you actually perceive as it as solid, you may not find. Okay, but analytically, you also actually break this down like we did this morning. So then you ask, where is the bell? What is the bell? Is this the bell? Or is this the bell? Or is this rim is the bell? And so if you analyze that, you will not find a bell. Okay? So loving kindness and compassion does not analyze like the object of your loving kindness or the oneself. It simply cultivates this kind thoughts, compassionate thoughts, but hasn't actually eliminate the self. So because of the existence, self-existence of this, and now we may form grasping on this. Okay? And then we may want this. Or if someone takes away, then we may feel threatened and protect this. Like that. Okay? So the point is, loving kindness, compassion are helpful antidote. But if you really want to reduce the root source of suffering, then you need to cultivate bodhicitta. Okay, so bodhicitta actually, well, this is how it is distinguished. Loving kindness is a mind that focuses on benefiting others. And compassion is a mind that aspires to free from the suffering of others, mainly. Whereas bodhicitta is mind that aspires to achieve enlightenment for all living beings. Okay. So bodhicitta is a totally different level of consciousness. Bodhicitta is primarily focusing on others. Bodhicitta is focusing on others. And one actually, of course, we need to have loving kindness, compassion, and then practice bodhicitta. So you cannot skip this one, because then you will really, it will not be stable to do bodhisattva practices like bodhicitta. And Pat, you have a question?
It was just what the last word you said.
So last bodhicitta
Focuses on
others.
Others.
Yes, others. Of course, the loving kindness, compassion focuses others, but the degree of focusing on other is much greater with bodhicitta practice. Bodhicitta practice, you really actually drop your self-cherishing mind, and you, depending on the state within the bodhisattva practice, you actually adopt cherishing others. Okay. Just the definition, these three. Bodhicitta definition is much broader. Because bodhicitta is a mind that aspires to achieve enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. So if you have this intention, this motivation, that you want to achieve enlightenment in order to benefit all living beings. That means you will be very active. First of all, you may really focus on what is the root source of suffering. And then you find that. And then you learn how to manage. And you learn that. And then you are so dedicated for others. Other is limitless as space. So basically, you made a commitment that you are not interested in self-realization, self-liberations, like arhats, who focus primarily for their own liberation from the suffering and its causes. Okay. So bodhicitta is much, much broader practice than loving kindness and compassion. But in order to cultivate bodhicitta, it is required to practice loving kindness and compassion. Okay. And then, of course, then not only bodhicitta, then you also engage with bodhisattva practices of six paramitas and others like that. Okay. Probably I will share with you tomorrow. But at this point, any question? Mm-hmm.
So there was a part quite a while back where you were talking about self in context.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were talking recently, more recently, about loving kindness, compassion,
mm-hmm.
and bodhicitta.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to ask, and then I was sort of starting to try and imagine myself the answer about the relation between those two, because it occurred to me that self in context. You know, because you talked about the happiness that there's no insight, and then the self in context, which felt sort of like, I don't know, I'm trying to
mm-hmm.
put those two together or see how they fit or don't fit, if that makes sense at all, what I'm saying, because I'm thinking, like you said, that in the bodhicitta, you don't even care about self anymore. So
you do care.
Well,
let me clarify about the bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, I usually say bodhicitta primarily focuses on others.
Mm-hmm.
Secondarily focuses oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a total. But here's what happens. If you become a bodhisattva practitioner, you are helping others, but then you get all the benefits. Okay. So that means you do have a self. It's not that you eliminate the self while you are bodhisattva. But you are able to regulate, direct yourself. If you are focusing too much on self, then direct yourself focusing on others. And if you're focusing too much on others, then you direct to yourself. So initially that might be the practice, but then the higher level of bodhisattva then actually will be very, very dedicated for others. Uh-huh.
I guess I'm a little confused, because it almost seems at this higher level that this distinction between self and others dissolves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the sense that there's this recognition of interconnectedness that's so powerful that that distinction that you're talking about almost seems to me to start to wash away.
Wash away meaning?
That sense of self, strong sense of self and strong sense of other over there starts to unravel.
Mm-hmm.
And that interconnectedness becomes more powerful. So it's almost like you can't help but help yourself by helping others. That's sort of the way I've thought about it. Is that incorrect?
So you help others. It's a very, very complicated little bit. And I know every green student asks, can you be altruistic without benefiting self? But anyhow, so your intention as a bodhisattva, your intention is helping others. Your intention is not like focusing how I can achieve enlightenment. So your intention is dedicating for others. But while you do that, Bodhisattva herself, himself, gets all the benefit. Can you say again what you are trying to say?
Well, I'm just not sure that at this level the concept of self as separate from others makes a whole lot of sense to me.
Oh, okay.
It's almost, you know, some people talk about interbeing,
in
which we
yes.
are all interbeings.
Yes, yes.
You know, I am elements, I am my mother, I can't conceive myself without my mother or father, I can't conceive myself without the elements, I can't think about a rose without thinking about sunshine and earth and rain. So the notion of separateness that's in this is what I'm tripping
I see.
Over here.
Mm-hmm.
I see. So, Zach, you, and then I will respond.
Sure.
Yes?
Well, there's two kinds of bodhicitta, right?
Right,
there's absolute and relative.
Yes.
And but they're describing the same thing, right? So if we're thinking about things as ourselves, then that's relative bodhicitta, and the absolute bodhicitta is the interdependence or emptiness, right? Basic idea, like in Lojong teachings, they talk about absolute
yes.
and relative bodhicitta.
There is, and I will come back the clarifications. Okay, so here's what is important. Yes, in reality, everything is interdependent. But at the same time, so there's two things. One is appearance, another is reality. So in reality, we are all connected, self and other. And that is also very, very valid reason how things are not independent, not inherently existent, because everything is depend each other. But appearance-wise, we do appear as self and others, different genders, different nationalities. So in that sense, we are separate. But here's what is happening. So sometimes we really caught up just the appearance of the separateness. Then sometimes we also caught up with the reality that we are interdependent nature. So that means the point is that we need to have both. And in practice, you actually go both ways. when you need interdependent, you realize that. And you need the existence of yourself separately at that time you need, but not staying one place. So that's why in Buddhist philosophy, two truths are introduced. And so you live with both two truths and not just living with ultimate, then that really ignores the whole existence or appearance. And that's considered as one extreme. At the same time, one totally live with only experience, appearances, and that is also another extreme. So, madhyamic philosophy, meaning the free from these two experiences and live with both. And so idea is that you live both. Okay, so there's a separateness, but there is a connectedness. There's connectedness, there's a separateness. And so you go with both, and that's really the practice. Yes?
So, considering people take bodhisattva vows to place others before self, but then where is that gray area of when the compassion fatigue sets in and you
right.
just say,
Right. So, all our practices and level of practices, paths, are not like permanent. So therefore, as we continue in our practice, we need to maintain the early stages of practice. So maintaining those, and then you bring new practices. So what I'm saying is, when you become a bodhisattva, you do not become bodhisattva 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you, I usually use Democrats and Republicans. So if you consider yourself as a Democrat, that doesn't mean that now you are forever a Democrat. But you can persist yourself. But since I register for Democrat Party, now I am Democrat. You can say that. But in reality, whether you are Republican or Democrat depend on the definition. So if the two parties' definition are based on their values, then your value changes. You one day you are Democrat in terms of value, what is written in a Democrat or Democratic Party?
Mm-hmm.
Which one?
Either one.
Democratic.
Okay, so Democratic value. And then after a week or 1 month, actually you have a Republican values, what you're thinking towards someone else. So that means you're not Democrat all the time. And same thing for Republicans. Once they register, that doesn't mean now they are forever. So that's the metaphor, that once you become Buddhist, we're not 24 hours Buddhist, because we have to follow the definition of what Buddhist is, okay? So what I'm saying is, once you become Bodhisattva, you could become Theravadin, because Bodhisattva, Theravadin, all are based on the path and practices, not like the name and a title that we took. So in other words, you have a flexibility to go morning you are bodhisattva, and evening when you are stressed out, you need to handle your stress and you become terrible. Okay, and then when you go to bed, you think about benefits of bodhicitta, and you become a bodhisattva at that time.
Mm.
So everything changes, and nothing to be attached. Okay. Got it? I hope.
Got it.
Got it.
People say, "Got it." Something.
Got it.
Except my work, I am still in Tibetan family, so I lost lots of American cultures and the language and lots of things. My life actually seems a little bit unusual. I'm in Olympia, but then besides my work, I live myself, and so sometimes, except meeting my cousin or a few activities, it's a, so in other words, it's a very strange. I could say that I have been in Olympia more than 26 years now, but I might have lived just by myself. All right. So, any other questions? Yes.
So, you're saying sort of, you're using the word Theravada
mm-hmm.
versus bodhicitta, and,
mm-hmm.
but really, when you're, instead of putting those words,
mm-hmm.
sometimes you're earning merit by practicing Dharma for others
mm-hmm.
because your bodhicitta is so open, you want everyone to receive the benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But at other times, you really want to beseech the blessings upon yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Instead of calling it Theravada.
Right.
Because
so,
that concerns me a
right.
little, because there's millions of Theravadins
oh, yes.
in the southern countries.
Right, right.
They're not just all constantly praying for themselves. They
no, no.
They're also have bodhicitta.
Well, they have a bodhicitta.
They don't?
They have
they
a bodhicitta.
Do? They do?
It's a different.
Different.
So they have a bodhicitta. In that context, bodhicitta means bodhi. Is arhat.
Arhat.
So their mind is to achieve arhat.
Oh.
Okay.
But for themselves.
Yeah. Primarily. That's
primarily.
Why I say Theravada means primarily focusing on one's own liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Secondarily, altruistic and focusing others. But then bodhisattvas primarily focusing on others, secondarily focusing oneself.
Mm-hmm.
So we do not actually completely eliminate the self or the others. It's always there, so that is always there. But it's a matter of focus
mm-hmm. I
on
see.
One.
I do.
Mm-hmm.
I got it.
Okay.
I got it.
Yeah. Yes.
Actually, I remember something you said either last retreat or the one before, and I think you just drew a diagram of like, you know, Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana, and you said that the practitioner actually just jumps around between
yes.
those.
Yes.
And it doesn't matter whether, you know, you
mm-hmm.
consider yourself as mainly one or the other, you're always just by normal day-to-day life and practice, you're going to be jumping around between them. And I thought
right.
that was really useful because it's
yes.
like a visual reference. You know that you're jumping around.
Right, so you're going like this.
Right.
If the level is like this, then you go like this.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you stay there, then you come like this. Okay? So you really, so it's not a lineal. It is going like this. And it's good to be like this. Very, very practical. very, very humble, realistic. So you are not attached to your ideal identity of that I am Bodhisattva. Okay, so now let's do some fun activities. I hope it is fun. So let's bring your